Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity is off on assignment following the Louisiana governor's race. Daniel Foster of National Review Online is here in his place and doing a great job this week. And I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Dan, let's start with the good martini, and that's that once again, federal authorities have done an excellent job of sniffing out a potential terrorist plot, one that officials are now calling the most sophisticated since 9/11. This is a potential terrorist from up in the Northeast who wanted to fly remote control planes into places like the Pentagon and the U.S. Capitol. So, you know, we've seen obviously a couple of lucky situations, for lack of a better term, when you talk about the underpants bomber or the Times Square bomber. But this is yet another example of, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge plot and some of these others that were smoked out way ahead of time. And fortunately, no one's life is going to be in danger thanks to the fact that we were on top of this one.
Yeah, you just really have to give it to the law enforcement community. And in this case, I mean, there's no doubt they took this guy through the motions. It was a sting operation, but they took this guy through all the steps. They sold him fake plastic explosives. They sold him a bunch of machine guns. He drew up very detailed plans and schematics for how this would go down. And this kid, by the way, you know, the era we live in, the story broke after a Justice Department release, and within a half an hour I was Googling around for his name. He has a very unique name. In fact, there's only one listed in the United States in the White Pages. So, and within 15 minutes, I'm on the MySpace page of this 26-year-old terrorist, awful punk rock band, which he's the drummer for. I mean, his plot is not a laughing matter, but this was sort of silly. But you know what? It also is another data point for Peter King, for Representative King, who's had these American Muslim radicalization hearings going on for the past few months and who's been criticized, saying that there is no real radicalization problem with American Muslims. But here we have a case of a guy who grew up outside of Boston. The photograph of him that I found shows him in a Chicago Bulls jersey. He was part of this punk rock band. One of their songs is called Gaza Dozer, which I think is a reference to an American college student who was killed in the Gaza Strip when she was there protesting the IDF, who's kind of become a martyr for anti-Israeli movements. You know, Iran named a street after this girl. And so there's evidence right there out there on MySpace of perhaps this guy's potential radical leanings. Luckily, I don't know if that was the entree, you know, that the FBI used, but luckily they smoked out this plot and got him before he could execute it.
Yeah, folks, you know, probably going to try and water this down, saying he's a lone wolf, like they tried to say about the Fort Hood shooter and so forth. But when you look at some of these quotes that the authorities have turned over from, you know, Allah has given us the privilege of taking out the head and the heart of the snake. I mean, it's very consistent with a lot of the radical rhetoric you hear overseas. I don't think the FBI was planting this on him, although I'm sure they were trying to elicit as much as possible to make their case as strong as possible. But the bottom line is this was a great sting operation. Hopefully it goes well in court. And most importantly, the plot that this guy was only all too eager to be a part of never got off the ground. So that's excellent news. On to martini number two now. Dan, I don't know if coming in a distant second in the Florida straw poll, seeing his numbers tumble in Iowa, really triggering the rumors of Chris Christie getting in the race, has made this for a slightly difficult week for Texas Governor Rick Perry. I think it's pretty safe to say that that's true. But all of a sudden now, he's walking back his statement from the previous debate, suggesting that if you didn't like his illegals going to college, paying in-state tuition, that you don't have a heart. He's saying that was probably a little too strong. I think that's pretty safe to say that that did not go over well. The question is now is whether it's too late. Obviously, everybody wants to turn every story into a make-or-break story for a campaign, so I think it's probably not a death knell for him, but it's not only a problem of how he phrased it, but a problem of him on this issue, which I don't know that he's walking back a whole lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts to the race right now, and I think he's suffering from most of them. It's complicated. I mean, when Perry came in, he sucked a lot of the oxygen out of the Bachman campaign, obviously, because he appealed to the more conservative Midwestern Tea Party element of the Republican electorate, and therefore diminished Michelle Bachman's standing. But at the same time, now that Bachman's been made irrelevant and Perry's starting to stumble, we see this Kane surge. It's like a delicate dance. We see this Kane surge because Kane appeals to a lot of the same people that Bachman and Perry both did. But Bachman is now considered unelectable and untouchable, more or less. Perry still has a fighting chance, and yet now you can see a lot of his oxygen getting sucked away by Kane. And the Christie example is also interesting here, too, because not only did Christie, who's not running, I'm now convinced, finally, not only did Christie get to the right of Perry on this, saying that, I don't support in-state tuition for illegals and never have, but as my boss Rich Lowry pointed out, Perry is suffering from what Christie has been smart enough to avoid, which is that essentially Perry was talked into running for president. This was not in his game plan even, 6 months ago. So he was talked into running for president, and I think you're starting to see that both in terms of how unpolished his message is and in terms of, him stumbling in that last debate, him sounding like he was falling asleep at the podium. He said after the debate, "I'm tired." I believed him. I just don't think he was ready organizationally. I mean, he's a formidable fundraiser. Everybody knows how good he is at retail politics, but his stumbles on message, on delivery, have all indicated that he just wasn't quite ready and wasn't 100% in this in the way that Mitt Romney is. And so that's going to be a big handicap for him going forward. I don't think he's over. I don't think it's irrecoverable, but it's certainly going to be a bigger challenge than it looked like a month ago.
Absolutely right. It'll be very interesting to watch. Not sure when the next debate is. The later the better, in my opinion, but it'll give all these people a chance to hone their messages. I don't think we need one every week at this point like we had there for a little while this month.
And then, yeah. And then especially because TV ads are going to start to become a factor, so you're really going to see the field sharpen up, and we're going to find out who's real and who's not in the next few weeks.
On to martini number three now. And Dan, you and I were talking about first principles yesterday, so I know when folks look at the Constitution and they think about what's the first and highest duty of government, what's the most important thing our government's supposed to do for us? A lot of folks would say national security or preserving liberties, but not for New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He was addressing the UN, of all places, last week, and here's what Michael Bloomberg had to say was the highest order of government.
To halt the worldwide epidemic of non-communicable diseases, governments at all levels must make healthy solutions the default social option. That is, ultimately, government's highest duty.
Two reactions to this after seeing him make this address at the UN. Dan, first of all, I can't imagine the folks in debt-ridden nations in Western Europe trying to sit through this while he's prattling on about, lower salt levels and trans fats in foods. And then you got other people worried about the Middle East and all these sorts of other things. And he's just going on and on and on. And secondly, who in the world convinced this guy, other than perhaps the First Lady, that healthy eating options are the most important thing any government can do? I think most rational people would say the government has far more important things to do, and any involvement in this area is meddling at best.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head. If it would be one thing if we were kind of all living in a decadent but comfortable liberal utopia where all the major problems had been solved of want and need and insecurity, and there were no wars to fight, and we weren't $14 trillion in debt. But the fact of the matter is all those things are not true. And we have much bigger fish to fry than how many fried fish I'm allowed to eat. So I thought that was absurd. And you're right. I mean, he knew exactly what he was saying. Also, there's something I know technically the definition of epidemic can include non-communicable diseases, but it's a weird thing to call, high cholesterol or, diabetes an epidemic, right? Because it might be true that governments should be able to wield unusual powers akin to wartime powers if we had, say, a massive outbreak of the bird flu or a massive outbreak of Ebola, a contagion type situation, to plug a movie that's out in theaters. Then we could get into an interesting argument about where the government's ultimate duty to protect our life, liberty, and property, which, by the way, are the real ultimate duties of at least this government,
right.
We could have a legitimate debate about, whether or not it'd be okay or justified for a federal government to declare martial law in a situation like that, do things it might not otherwise do, whether in essence it could act as if it were under its wartime powers. But, that's a lot different than, cut down on the donuts and take the salt out of out of your fried food. To make the obvious point, we're all going to die sometime. And, I wrote an article in one of the recent issues of the magazine about these new warning labels that are going to appear on cigarettes across the country. They're going to show guys with holes in their throats and people with their chests stitched up on an autopsy table. And it's just incredibly condescending and ultimately contempt, this attitude of contempt that your government has for you and your ability to make decisions. It's one thing to say the government should protect my life from imminent threats to its security, that is, from violence from other people, you know, by other people. It's another thing for the government to tell me the manner in which I want to conduct my life and the way at which I arrive at my ultimate demise. You know, if I decide that smoking a couple of cigarettes and having you know, that bacon cheeseburger is worth it for me because I'm going to enjoy the ride on the way to where we all inevitably end up, you know, that's my decision. It's not Nanny Bloomberg's decision.
Yeah, exactly right. Very well stated as usual. Dan, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Daniel Foster of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.